May the words from my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable to you, our rock and our redeemer. So I was out for a walk by the water this week, and in the midst of this weather where we are seeing snow and then rain, thaw and then freeze again, I noticed the ice close to the shore was beginning to break up, and it was breaking up in great slabs, like an enormous complete jigsaw puzzle, breaking into smaller slabs with edges that would still fit perfectly together. And all of it perched atop a larger body of H2O in another shape, same stuff. And with the longer days and the warming earth and the heat of the sun, these two would become one again, all in liquid form until again, the rolling of the seasons. And it came to me rather forcefully that this was rather an apt metaphor for the message this morning. From Psalm 19, we hear the heavens are telling the glory of God. The firmament proclaims God's handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. And all this without one word being heard, without one word being spoken. And there are no need of words, no articulation to be made. It is a case of res ipsa loquitur, one of the few Latin phrases I've retained from law school, and it means the thing speaks for itself. The awe and the wonder of the night sky. Do you remember it? Do you recall when you were far enough out of the city and the lights did not obscure your vision? When you laid back on a beach or in a field and simply looked up. What a vision. What a display. And the next paragraph of this psalm, the next stanza of this poem, speaks of the sun on its course, rising from the ends of the earth, the ends of the heavens, and running its circuit each day. And nothing is hid from its heat. Each day following night, this glowing ball moving in its appointed course across the heavens. And each night, the darkness bringing millions, billions of points of light in a blue-black sky. Now, when most of us think of the incarnation, the Word made flesh, we immediately turn to the birth of this Jesus, to God becoming Jesus in human form, God's radical demonstration of unity with humanity. But this is not the first incarnation. How could it be? The ancients saw this way, way back, and somehow we pretty much lost it, or ignored it, or downright refuted it in the rolling of the years. Consider this. Creation was the first Bible, and it existed, our best science tells us, 13.7, I don't know how they got the 0.7, 13.7 billion years before the second Bible was written. Now, we may never know the how or the when of the universe, but the question religion seeks to answer most of the time is the why. Why did God create? And the answer, at least for me, and I think perhaps the only way forward on this hurting planet, is this. Creation was the first incarnation. God poured God's self out as creation. God radically demonstrated unity with all finite visible forms, everything from rocks to dirt to water to plants, organisms, animals, and human beings. To everyone and everything here and now. The sheer diversity and number on this list is breathtaking. Everything visible, without exception, then and now, is the outpouring of God. Do we not hear echoes of this? I don't know how we missed this. Do we not hear echoes of this in the opening of the Gospel of John? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, without a sound being made. Without knowing what we now know, without uncovering what we have now uncovered in all the sciences about the nature, the interconnection, and the composition of all on this planet, without knowing that, the ancients got this in spades. We are standing on the shoulders of giants. The pouring, the adoration, and the outpouring of praise of God in creation in the psalm then turns to adoration and praise of the law. We turn from creation writ large to the created, from the general to the specific, from the cosmic to the moral, from creation to Torah, the template for Exodus living in covenant as God's people. We hear God's law revives the soul. God's rule guides the simple. God's demands delight the heart. God's decrees stand forever. God's judgments keep their truth. And what are these laws? Well, fortuitously, we are given them in our second reading, read by Lynn, and we turn there now. The giving of these laws, the Ten Commandments as they have come to be known by God to Moses on Mount Sinai in the time of the Exodus, form the basis of living in covenant relationship, first with God and then with one another. There is a gift by God, and there is the resulting response to that gift. There is creation, and there is living in creation. Now, many of you can probably recite all 10, perhaps learning them in confirmation class or in Sunday school. I'm told in some places they hang in courthouses and in homes, and in some churches they are even recited following the prayer of confession as a reminder. They are a partial blueprint for living in community well and for seeking to live lives less fragmented. In Precy, the Ten Commandments are, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make idols. You shall not take the Lord's name in vain. Keep the Sabbath day holy. Honor your father and your mother. I love that one. Honor your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, and you shall not covet. Like the boundary lines on a football field or a soccer pitch, the commandments outline basic expectations of human behavior, and they protect the community from running out of bounds and falling into patterns of behavior that will lead to conflict and to strife. At the same time, they provide encouragement for a healthy love of God and neighbor. Sort of a social contract for the people of the covenant, if you remember your much later 18th century Enlightenment philosophers. And there is an internal cohesiveness to these 10. The way we attend to God in the first 4 shapes the way we attend to the neighbor in the following 6. We are kneeling in the shelter of the ancients. But there are dangers inherent in any codified system. Legalism creeps in, and the letter of the law takes precedent over the spirit of the law. And perhaps this is one of Jesus' greatest gifts to us, if we would only see it. Justice is not of God if it is retributive and not restorative. And Jesus didn't think this up on his own. He was standing on the shoulders of ancients and sheltered in the presence of giants. Justice is not of God if it is retributive and not restorative. This is true whether we are dealing with ethics or theology, the earth that, and all that is in it and on it, human relationships, systems of government or economics, politics, and religion. Justice is not of God if it is retributive and not restorative. Now that's real easy to say on a Sunday morning, but it's more difficult to put into practice. But we are on the right track when we begin there. And so we come to Jesus, confronted by those holding stones ready to throw at this woman who has committed adultery, has broken the seventh commandment. Imagine the scene, the hostility. Whoever wrote down this passage had an eye for high drama. It is a really tense situation. A woman who is, of course, unnamed, is brought to Jesus, presumably caught just then in the act of adultery. And they say to Jesus, "What shall we do with her?" And Jesus does not intervene directly. He does not say, "Go ahead and stone her," which was the prescription under Mosaic law in those times for both parties involved. And neither does he say, ignoring the law, "Let her go free." He simply bends forward, and in one of the most mysterious and puzzling moments in the gospel, he begins to write in the earth, in the dirt, at his feet. Now, we have no idea what he wrote, but there was undoubtedly a period of silence as they watched and they stood. At first, all self-righteous, we've got this upstart now, this one who would question the status quo, perhaps stiff with condemnation. And then as the silence lengthens and Jesus continues to write in the dirt, feet begin to scuff, sideways glances at one another. "What the heck is he doing?" they think. And the pause lengthens, and then Jesus straightens up and says, "Let anyone who is without sin among you cast that first stone." And then the story says, they all went away, the eldest first. And Jesus straightens up and says to the woman, "Is there anyone who condemns you?" And she says, "No." And he says, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." And what is instructive today in this message is not Jesus' words, but Jesus' actions, Jesus' teaching. The moment of silence when Jesus stooped to write whatever he wrote in the dirt, the time of silence was the putting of each one of those there into thinking, into reflecting, into accessing, into sober second thought, literally the pause that refreshes, the invitation to restart. And because Jesus loved God and knew God loved all, he waits. He waits for their hearts to speak, for the still small voice to be heard, for that boundary to bulge, for God's law to revive the soul. And then he speaks when they are able to hear. To be as aware as Jesus was of his participation in the palpable presence of God's love, the absence of fear, this is to live from a place of permanent, ever-present trust. What a gift! He saw it everywhere and in everything. And to be Jesus-like is to have the power to speak directly and eventually to that exquisitely vulnerable, precious part of each one of us. He did it then, and he does it now. He does not assume those who accuse are bad. He does not assume the woman accused is bad. He does not assume they are idiots or incapable of discernment. No, he simply waits. He waits for the love of God to speak in their souls, their unconscious, their hearts. I don't care what you call it. He waits for God to speak. The second incarnation, waiting for the first. Writing in the dirt, waiting for an answer. Well, let's try this one. Work up to loving God. Start by loving the humblest and simplest things and then move up from there. Don't start by trying to love God or even people. Love rocks and dirt, the elements first. Move to the trees, then animals, and then humans. Angels will soon then seem like a real possibility, and God is then just a short leap away. In fact, consider this. This might be the only way to love, because how you do anything is how you do everything. From John's first letter, anyone who says they love God and hates their sibling is a liar. Now, we don't often think of Jesus as politician or as mayor. We've done a pretty good job of separating church from state. But there was no such division in first century Jerusalem. But we can take lessons about leadership from the story of Jesus' life. Every utterance of any power, positive or negative, carries a certain civic power as well, for good or for its opposite. If we base our communal lives together on appealing only to those things which diminish us or seek to somehow diminish God, then we need new leadership. The passage Jesus spoke today carries huge weight. Huge power, not in what he said, but what he did. A power that did not dictate, only waited and watched and modeled. Utterances that pit one against the other, that pit us one against each other, are not inspired, they are expired. It is the pregnant pause in our life together that allows us the space to become who we really are. Loved, capable of recognizing that we are not just humans having individual God experiences, but as our Eucharist begs us, shows us, tells us, we are somehow God having a human experience. In life and in death and in life beyond death. And this isn't arrogance, this is gift. We are standing on the shoulders of giants. We are kneeling in the shelter of the ancients. Each division of culture, denomination, race, a slab of ice floating on the one sea. Each denomination, culture, race, religion, invited to little by little, increment by increment, experience by experience, both those of suffering and those of joy. Invited to what I would tell my children when they ask me such questions, invited to recognize the undivided divinity of all matter, God poured out on all things. If God so loved the world that he poured out his love in creation, and in Jesus, then our loving God and one another becomes the only response. This was perhaps what the second incarnation, this Jesus, now the Christ, is writing in the dirt in our 21st century. All are one. And endlessly waiting and waiting for us to read and to hear and to know that to be so and to act accordingly. Amen.